Our next talk is entitled Allergies, You Sneeze, You Lose. And Dr. Douglas Jones will be giving that talk. He is board certified by the American Board of Allergy and Immunology and the American Board of Internal Medicine. He attended the University of Utah, where he received a Bachelor of Arts in Biology. Jones earned his Doctor of Medicine from Penn State University College of Medicine in 2003. He completed a residency program in internal medicine and subspecialty training in allergy, asthma, and immunology at Creighton University Medical Center in 2008. He founded the Rocky Mountain Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology in 2008, which has developed expertise in the quality care of allergy, asthma, and immunologic disorders for both pediatric and adult patients and food allergy treatment. And so Dr. Jones will be next. Hopefully this is fixed for you. Do we know if this is?
Well, it's great to be with you. I'm excited to be at this meeting. It's actually the first one I've been able to attend. The objectives that I have, the committee asked me to focus on three specific areas. And is there any way to flip the slides? Do I do that? Do we know how to flip the slides? I guess we don't know how to go to the slides, so I'm just going to talk about it. How's that? The committee asked me to focus on three specific areas today with primary emphasis on my first objective, and that's to go over and understand the basics of allergen immunotherapy, and that includes both sublingual immunotherapy and subcutaneous immunotherapy. Those are often referred to as allergy shots or allergy drops. The second objective that I'll touch on at the end is also understanding the uses of allergy testing, whether it's skin testing versus blood testing. And then they also wanted me to provide an introduction into an emerging therapy that I have about 3 years of experience in called food oral immunotherapy. So those are the things that I'm going to discuss today. The disclosures that you see on that slide, not really relevant to my topic, which is nice. So, do you have copies of the slides? No? Okay. On the Office of Inspector General actually did a... I can? All right, good. There we go. Gotcha. Yep. Okay, sorry about that technical issue. The Office of Inspector General did a pretty good review of allergen immunotherapy several years ago, and what they found were a lot of mistakes, and that's kind of the purpose of this slide. And what they looked at was to see if allergen immunotherapy and related services met Medicare coverage, documentation, and requirements, and if the allergen immunotherapy provided to Medicare beneficiaries was of a quality that met professionally recognized standards of healthcare. Again, this was several years ago, but what they found was, in their report, 62% of allergen immunotherapy and related services allowed by Medicare in 2001 did not meet program requirements, resulting in improper payments of $75 million. Again, that's over a decade and a half ago when they found this. Care provided to approximately 70% of Medicare beneficiaries who received allergen immunotherapy in 2001 was inconsistent with professionally recognized standards of health care. 20% did not have conditions for which allergy shots were appropriate, and they did not have tests that showed reactions to any potential allergens. I find that alarming. 13% was contraindicated by concomitant conditions or the use of beta blockers. So as we look at that, I want to set the table because obviously this was in 2001, so 15 years ago. This has been on the radar of the government and also insurance companies for several years. And as was Dr. Barlow mentioned, we live in a new era where there's never been more I call it the Shun era, not S-H-U-N, but legislation, administration, regulation, litigation, right? We live in that area, and the doctor-patient has really taken a back seat. But these are important issues in the era that we live in, where if certain mistakes or improper use has been identified, you can only imagine that increased scrutiny will come forward in the years to come. I've even noticed in my own practice just in the last 6 months an increase from insurance companies in terms of what we have to document, how we have to document, what we have to justify and show to them in terms of proper use of allergen immunotherapy. So this is a very important topic. And so what we like to do is in that case, go back to the evidence, go back to science, go back to the basics. In 2011, this was the last update from the journal that was found in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. It's allergen immunotherapy. It was an update on practice parameters. Hopefully they'll come up with an updated version pretty soon, but really this provides a nice foundation for allergen immunotherapy. By way of definition, it is, as probably most of you are aware of, it's repeated administration of specific allergens to patients with IgE-mediated conditions for the purpose of providing protection against the allergic symptoms and inflammatory reactions associated with natural exposure to the allergens. It goes by all kinds of names, hyposensitization, allergen-specific desensitization, shots, drops, and I think they're my essential oils, basically. If you look at kind of some of the major allergens, that's just a list of some of the major allergens that are out there: trees, grass, weeds, dust mites, cats, dogs, molds, that type of thing. This isn't obviously a slide meant for you all to read. It's mainly for reference, just to know what's out there. There are a number of standardized extracts which are preferred because they are standardized versus we use a lot of non-standardized extracts, mainly out of necessity. Here's some examples of effective doses of extracts. Mainly just for reference. This isn't necessarily for memorization, but it just shows you of a lot of those standardized extracts, we do have effective dose ranges that we want to target when we are utilizing immunotherapy. So proper indications, obviously allergic rhinitis, allergic conjunctivitis, allergic asthma, stinging insects, that would be venoms such as bees, wasps, fire ants, hornets, those types of things. It can be an indication in atopic dermatitis where aerial allergen sensitization plays a part. So not every case of eczema, is necessarily related to aero allergens, but in the case that it is, then it may be an indication. It is not currently indicated for food allergy, although this is emerging, and I will discuss that at the end. And it is not indicated for chronic urticaria or angioedema. Some relative contraindications include significant immunodeficiency, malignancy, severe psychological disorders, poor compliance with medications, treatment with beta blockers, severe obstructive lung disease, conditions that may contraindicate epinephrine use, because obviously any type of immunotherapy, there's risk of anaphylaxis, and we've got to be able to treat with epinephrine. There are some exceptions to these contraindications when we talk about venom immunotherapy, because the risk of a person not receiving venom immunotherapy may be greater than some of these relative contraindications. So those have to be discussed on more of a case-by-case basis. It has proven effective for a number of things listed there: pollen, animal allergens, dust mites, molds, again, venoms. There is limited data on cockroach allergen immunotherapy. So the effects can be long-term. You may produce a long-term cure with venom, decrease clinical symptoms and drug usage, decreased response in terms of allergen challenge tests. You just get an overall reduction. I often talk to people How I describe it is if allergies are on a volume dial and that volume say it's set at 10, you know, when we do allergy and immunotherapy, we're turning the volume down. And there is a potential to mute that volume. And so once that volume gets turned down, we are able to reduce their medication usage, and also reduce their symptoms, and consequently patients experience an improved quality of life. This isn't necessarily new information, but I think it's really important, and in terms of sublingual drops or sublingual immunotherapy, it's also just some newer information where allergy shots or drops may prevent new sensitizations. So if you look at the graph here, those on immunotherapy versus the control group, there's 22 patients in the immunotherapy group. Almost half of them did not produce any new sensitizations once they were on immunotherapy, whereas in the control group, none of them did. And I find that pretty significant. That's just a paper that showed pollen immunotherapy reduces the development of asthma. So if immunotherapy, for instance, is started in a younger patient prior to asthma starting, obviously those patients, if they are highly allergic, they are at risk of asthma development. And as such, consequently, you've got a lot of medications, a lot of monitoring, a lot of follow-up. If we can prevent that, that would obviously be ideal. Allergen immunotherapy, when started soon enough, has been shown to prevent asthma in many cases. So the incidence of the asthma is reduced. Again, I think that's an important piece. I think that was one of the driving factors. If you look at the new asthma guidelines, that's why if you look at the stepwise therapy, allergen immunotherapy is included in asthma treatment guidelines nowadays. As we look at subcutaneous immunotherapy shots versus sublingual immunotherapy, this isn't a case of Democrats versus Republicans, okay? This isn't a case where we're fighting and who's right and who's wrong, but rather what we want to do is present some data and just show risks, benefits of each, quality, cost, control measures, and how each of these might be used to best benefit an individual patient. So just kind of a summary there, if you look at allergy shots, which has obviously been used for 100 years. The extracts are FDA approved for injection. We get pretty nice insurance coverage. There's various buildup schedules to reach a maintenance, and typically maintenance shots are given every 2 to 4 weeks in a physician's office. With allergy drops, currently there are only three, or not drops necessarily, but just sublingual immunotherapy. There are only three FDA approved tablets currently available. One contains and treats ragweed, and the other two contains and treats grass allergy. There's differences in each of those. In terms of FDA-approved extracts that we use for allergy shots, they're off-label usage for sublingual immunotherapy, and so insurance does not cover it, and that would necessitate a cash payment by the patient. These are dosed daily by holding either the tablet or the drops under the tongue for a period of time and then swallowed. Spitting it out generally isn't recommended. And currently, any form of sublingual immunotherapy is not recommended for venom. If we look at efficacy, I'm just going to focus a little more on sublingual because I think the efficacy for shots is pretty well established. But the majority of sublingual studies have shown and demonstrated either improved symptom scores, medication scores, or both. Recent studies have suggested a relationship, though, between dose and efficacy with slit. But again, a consistent relationship between dose, duration, efficacy still has yet to be established. If you look at slit dosing outside of the FDA-approved tablets, obviously, if you just look at slit dosing in general, it's all over the map. I've seen all kinds of doses, and that range may be up to 30,000, you know, difference. So effective doses in most cases really haven't been established yet. A lot of it just goes off of, some may take it off of, you know, European data, which is different than US data, but again, it hasn't been well established. But in terms of efficacy, it has shown and demonstrated prevention of new sensitization, prevention of developing asthma, following a very similar pattern to allergy shots. There is greater improvement in shots when compared to drops when you look at the results of cumulative data over 6 years. In terms of safety, slits generally very well tolerated and pretty safe. No reports of slit-related fatalities. The most common side effects are oral mucosal symptoms. That will affect up to 75% of patients. In general, if they can tolerate it and continue, oftentimes those symptoms dissipate. Dose modifications are sometimes required. And this is obviously more common during a buildup phase. Severe reactions have been reported, although they are less frequent than allergy shots. It is really not well studied in severe asthma. If you look just briefly at SLIT USA versus Europe, one of the key components here is in Europe, they primarily will write just single allergen immunotherapy. It's where a lot of the studies are done. In the United States, we're different. We mostly will write for multiple allergen immunotherapy. If you look at mono versus polysensitized, the current US practice of using an average of 8 allergens in named patient preparations is not presently supported by direct evidence from large clinical trials. What they're saying there mainly is there's not a lot of great data on multiple allergen immunotherapy, even though we use it a lot. And that holds true for both shots and drops. On the basis of the published data, multi-allergen immunotherapy in polysensitized patients, whether delivered sublingually or subcutaneously, is going to require more supporting evidence. Again, just to tease out, you know, the most effective practices of this. Obviously, we're still using it. We still do it. But I think we could do a better job in terms of better, larger trials and really figuring out the nitty-gritty on that. Just as we look at just kind of a summary, SCIT versus SLIT, they're both effective in patients with seasonal allergic rhinitis. They can both induce long-term remission. They're both effective in patients with perennial rhinitis. Indirect evidence suggests SCIT is more effective than SLIT in seasonal allergic rhinitis. However, indirect evidence also suggests SLIT is better tolerated and safer than SCIT in patients with seasonal allergic rhinitis. Evidence in children, in both cases, less convincing, but more studies are needed. However, as we talked before, when we do this in children, we may have an added benefit of preventing asthma. Local side effects with allergy shots are common, mostly well tolerated. Again, the same with SLIT, local side effects, very, very common but well tolerated. SCIT requires administration in a physician's office. SLIT can be self-administered. Adherence with SCIT is easily monitored because they are coming into a physician's office, whereas with SLIT, adherence can be a problem. As we know, we send patients off and tell them to do something every day. It's challenging to get them to do something every day. So adherence can be a challenge at times with SLIT. Again, direct comparative evidence versus shots versus drops is pretty weak. There are some patients who are going to prefer SCIT. There are some patients that are going to prefer SLIT. But I think it's important that in any circumstance that, you know, proper evidence and proper discussions of risks, benefits, what expectations are, that those types of discussions need to be had with patients. There's a cost caveat, I would say, with when you look at SCIT versus SLIT. So we talk about dosing. Currently, SCIT and the FDA-approved SLIT tablets are covered by insurance. SLIT drops are not covered by insurance. Again, as I mentioned before, it would need to be a cash payment. When we talk about dosing, and those published data on the effective doses of SCIT, let's take grass, for instance. A monthly shot dose for grass is about 20 to 30 times less than the cumulative dose for SLIT. So if you take grass, just grass for instance, basically what a person is taking on a daily dose for grass is what they get in their monthly dose for subcutaneous immunotherapy. So if somebody's actually doing it right to try and achieve effectiveness, that could be pretty costly. Slit could be pretty costly to a patient to get high enough doses in there, especially when insurance isn't covering it. So I think that's just something that needs to be discussed with the patient and see if that's something that they're willing to do. But I think it can become quite cost prohibitive in some cases, especially when we're asking them to do that more long term. In general, just as kind of a summary on everything, if you look at this in kind of an equilibrium, shots likely a little more effective, a little more risk, whereas drops a little less effective, but the safety profile is a little better. In conclusion, on this piece, there's clear evidence of effectiveness of both slit and skit. Superiority of one mode of administration over the other could not be consistently demonstrated. Through indirect comparison and further research is needed to establish a comparative effectiveness between basically slit and skit. That's just talking about effectiveness. Again, there's also the other issues of cost, what's covered by insurance, and then we also have to take into consideration each patient's individual circumstances and what they are looking for in terms of a treatment, what their goals are, and I think that's just important where a physician is able to partner with a patient at that moment and really figure out how can we best meet their needs and how can we best support this patient. I just have one slide here on allergy testing, shots versus skin testing versus in vitro testing. Immunoassays, they're going to lack a risk of allergic reaction. That's an advantage. Results are not affected by medications, except prednisone can affect that. Results are not affected by conditions of the skin. Greater patient convenience, although I may argue that a bit. Easier to document quality control. So, you know, if somebody goes in and gets a blood draw, it's pretty easy to document quality control. When somebody's doing a skin test, it's really important that the person doing the test and the oversight of the person doing the test is appropriate. Goes back to the saying, crap in equals crap out. If somebody can't perform a good test, it can be operator dependent. And if somebody isn't doing a good test, you're gonna get bad results. If you get bad results, your treatment plan's gonna be altered in terms of how effectively you're treating that patient. So in terms of skin testing, you wanna make sure that operator, whoever's performing that test and the oversight of the test is appropriate. The advantage of the skin test, though, we do have greater sensitivity, so we can pick up more things than what we may pick up in blood tests. We have a wider selection of allergens, although some people go overboard on this and test a whole lot of clinically irrelevant allergens. I don't even know where they get access to some of these, but results are pretty immediately available. Typically, you're gonna test. 15, 20 minutes later, you're gonna have a reading on it, and you're gonna be able to have that discussion with the patient right now. Overall, there's less time and expense per test. My last topic, just in a few minutes so we can keep on time, is an emerging treatment called food immunotherapy. There's various forms of food immunotherapy. There's oral, there's slit, and there's also epicutaneous, which is basically a patch. OIT, we just abbreviate oral immunotherapy as OIT, has been shown to be effective, but there are side effects, and adverse effects can limit some. The most common side effects are GI symptoms, rash. There is a risk of anaphylaxis and also a risk of EOE, eosinophilic esophagitis. Slit, when compared to oral immunotherapy, has less side effects, but it's also less effective. There is still a risk of EOE with that. More data is needed for national organizations to back OIT for foods. A select group of allergists across the United States have been trained and are doing OIT. I'm one of them. I've used it now for almost 3 years and desensitized. When I had to submit this slide, we were close to 250. We're well over 250 now. But we've desensitized over 250 patients. When we say a 95% success rate, what I mean by that is 95% of the patients who start our program and have finished are now consuming foods that were once life-threatening to them in unlimited amounts. So that's what we mean by 95% success rate. So we've treated patients for milk, eggs, wheat, peanuts, soy, corn, and most tree nuts. And there's currently a phase 3 clinical trial for a peanut capsule, which they're seeking FDA approval for. So it's an emerging therapy. It's something that we'll see more and more of. Again, we've had good success with it, learned a lot with it, and it's really made a significant impact in a lot of our patients' quality of life. This is something that's mainly driven by patients because for those that are truly food allergic and living in those situations of they're almost in desperation because of the life that they have to live. And it's something that, as I talk to patients, touched my heart, and it's just something that we wanted to seek an answer and try and provide some solutions for them. And so this is something that you'll definitely see more of in the upcoming years. So thank you for your time, and do we have time for questions or no? Yes.
In immunotherapy, have you looked at all at shellfish?
Shellfish is done by a couple of people in the United States currently. There is no product that's under any kind of clinical trial investigation. I currently am not doing shellfish. It's been a difficult challenge finding products to be able to get starting doses low enough to be able to do shellfish, but I'm currently working on a shellfish protocol, and it will likely be shrimp. Yeah, good question. Any other questions?
Is the food immunotherapy, is that the patient is cured, or do they have to keep coming back to renew this?
So for those that may not have heard, he's asking if the food oral immunotherapy is a cure, or is it something they have to keep coming back for? That's a great question. It's still unanswered. The most recent data out of Stanford and the Food Allergy Research Center in Stanford would suggest there is a certain amount of percentage of patients that will be cured. There's a certain percentage of patients that will not be cured. And in those patients, what they have to do is they have to maintain a daily dose of their treatment. So basically, if we're desensitizing them to peanuts, for instance, they have to maintain a daily dose of a minimum amount of peanuts or a peanut product that we've discussed with them. So that's a great question. It'll still be determined in the future. But again, the most recent out of Stanford would suggest some patients will be cured in time, others will not. And they're actually doing studies on T cells and T cell markers and the DNA to figure out who may be able to be cured by this type of treatment versus those who, at minimum, will need to continue on a daily dose of that allergen to keep them safe. Yep.
Would you like to comment on the administration of peanut butter to babies?
Would I like to comment on it?
Yeah, to prevent...
I'd love to comment on it. Yeah, so obviously one of the hot topics over the last several months is in regards to the LEAP study that most people are aware of, where it's kind of a groundbreaking study. You know, for years and years, the recommendation was to avoid, you know, up to a certain age. Milk, eggs, peanut, that type of thing for a certain age. And then this LEAP study came out and kind of changed the thinking and changed the dynamic of that, where it suggests if we can administer peanut products earlier, peanut butter or Bamba, to babies earlier, we may prevent allergic sensitization in those kids. And so in certain high-risk populations, that may prove beneficial in terms of introducing peanuts earlier in their life. So the old thing of avoid, it's kind of going out the window. Yeah, one more? Okay, we got to go on. Sorry.